blessed.
That's what I like to hear. Good, good. I'm so glad. Well, if you've got a Bible with you or some means of looking at the Bible, if you'll turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going through the book of Ecclesiastes. Really appreciate Ruth sharing last week. That was really, really awesome. Got a lot of positive feedback that people were really blessed by that, Ruth, so appreciate you doing that. Tonight we're coming back to Ecclesiastes, and we've got to remember that this is an unusual book. It's been a difficulty for people throughout history. We believe it was probably written by Solomon. Ecclesiastes, the Kohelet, means that somebody who's in charge, means he's a teacher. We've been calling him the professor in this. But we see in what he's writing, he's also not just a teacher, but he's a seeker as well. He's trying to piece together the meaning of life, the purpose of it all. Ecclesiastes is a book that looks at life with a great deal of honesty. And I like that about this book. In some ways, as we read it, we feel like he's viewing life very jadedly, but he's pointing out some of the absurd things, the temporal nature of this life. And all of it, when it deals with those absurdities, is talking about observing life under the sun. That is, looking at life from the perspective of the natural light, something that doesn't take into account anything beyond just the normal patterns of this life outside of a spiritual worldview. And from that perspective, there's a lot about life that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's a lot of frustrating things that we deal with in this life, and it does seem pretty futile. But even so, even though it's so negative, or seems to be so negative, a lot of times, there's actually an underlying smile I perceive in this work. A sense that the professor knows something, that he's kind of cluing us in on little bits at a time. He hasn't tipped his hand fully yet, but he'll every once in a while, we'll see that again tonight, that something else shines through here. We get glimpses, like last time where he pulled back the curtain just a little bit and let the idea of a view of life from the perspective of God kind of stream in and give a different light to the picture there. Pointing out the absurdity of trying to find meaning in just the pursuit of pleasures in this life and just trying to find pleasure as an end in itself, but how life can be enjoyed when we see it as a gift from God, something that God's provided for us. And we remember, too, as we're reading through Ecclesiastes, we want to use our imagination here. We remember that we're reading it as though we're sitting in a study with a professor who's wearing a mortarboard and he's got his black robe on over top of a party till you puke shirt. He's wearing expensive Italian slacks with flip-flops on, and he's been smoking a pipe as he's there. And we've been listening as he's been enthralling us with his observations about light. And if you're there in chapter 3, the teacher has talked to us. He's applied his intellect to trying to find answers through his intellect, but that was a vapor. It was futility. And then he sought after pleasure, but he found that that was meaningless. So now he reaches up on the shelf, and he pulls out an old vinyl record of the Byrds' greatest hits. And he walks over to a turntable, and just before he puts the needle down on the record, he looks up at us and says, "You know, actually, Pete Seeger wrote this song, but the Byrds made it really popular. But in actuality, Pete Seeger didn't even write this song."
And the time to every girl's undo.
Okay, well, I know that was sort of cheesy, but it's the closest cultural connection that we can make to what it is that's being represented here and what we're going to read. The writer, we believe it's Solomon, the old professor, is going to break into some poetry here. It could very well be that it was a song. And it's a series of contrasts that he presents to us. We'll find that that song is actually pretty much verbatim for what's said here. It starts in verse 1. He says, "For everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die." I challenge you to read this without that tune going through your head now. "A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up." So here the poem is dealing with what is purely physical in the way of life. The things that we deal with in the observations of life. There's a time where we're born. There's a time that we pass from this life. Those are the markers. Those are the boundaries of the journey. That's the beginning and the end of the thing. And each one starts, each journey starts, and each journey ends. That's the truth for every human being on this planet. There's work that's done during that time, the physical work that we're about, the planting and the reaping and the fighting and the restoring and the demolition and the construction projects. And the repeated phrase, "a time," it comes up over and over in this, a time to, may be carrying with it a sense of monotony, a sense of this cyclical nature here, that no matter what it is that we set out to do during the span of our journey here in this life, we are subject to the seasons that come, to the time for everything that's already been ordained, that life moves in cycles and rhythms, and we see that represented all around us, and we have absolutely no control over it. We can say, well, I'm not really keen on having it get real hot this summer, so I'm done with summer, and we'll just move on into fall. Well, it's not going to happen that way. It doesn't work that way. We have no control over those things. And for every good thing that happens in this life, there's this corresponding bad thing that can happen as well, and vice versa. For every bad thing, that there can be a corresponding good thing. And then beyond just the physicality of this, we're born, we die, we do a bunch of stuff in between, there's the emotional response to that, the soulful response to these things in verse 4. A time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. There are times when we're carefree, and we're filled with joy and laughter and dancing. And there are also times when we feel the crushing weight of grief and weeping. And yet, both of these things that he describes here are temporary. Both of these things are subject to those patterns and those cycles. They come and they go. They come and they go. They're none of them permanent. So neither of these things, whether the happy things or the sad things, are the means by which we define ourselves as people. They're just experiences of our souls as they move through the rhythms and the patterns of this life, and we ride them like waves as they come to us. So we know that there's this physicality to life, there's this emotional, soulful response to these things, and then there is the purpose, the inner decisions, the intent of the spirit, which we see in the last part of the poem, verse 5. "A time to cast away stones, time to gather stones together." This is an agricultural kind of thing. It's either preparing a field for planting or actually ruining a field so that it can't be planted. "A time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing." There are times when friendship is vital and we need that cooperation. And then there are times, for whatever reasons, where friendship is at odds with our goals, that those kinds of embraces are not necessarily conducive to meeting our goals. Verse 6, "A time to seek, a time to lose." That is, that there's a time to determine that we're going to keep looking for something that we can't seem to find, that we're looking for, and there's a time to reconcile with the fact that we're not going to find it, that we may have to recognize it as lost. "A time to keep, a time to cast away." And we could interpret that as there are times in, and then we're talking about life under the sun. We're talking about the way that life just unfolds, that there are times when we've got to be frugal, that we're careful and storing up what we have, and then there's times that we're generous and we're carefree with the resources that we have. We give away. "There's a time to tear and a time to sow." I know nothing about that sort of thing. We'll pass that up. "A time to keep silence, a time to speak." This is, this is a true thing. There is a time to be silent. There is a time to speak. And I would say that for most of us, that's where the big struggle is, to learn the difference between the two of them. Because we usually, you know, we usually speak up when we should shut up. We hear some, you know, morsel thing, or we, you know, want to spout our opinion about something, and we just really need to be quiet. And then there are times when our voice needs to be heard, when we need to be a voice representing the cause of good or what's right, when it's important for us to be a voice, and we clam up. We don't say anything. And I think that's a struggle for everybody. But we know intrinsically that there are times for these things. There's a time for both of these things. A time to love, verse 8, a time to hate. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean love or hate people. We've got to be careful how we read that. There, you know, we think in terms of that. There are some things that when we look at that activities or practices or mindsets, you know, sometimes we'll look at that and say, well, you know, as Christians, we know there's never a time to hate. Well, actually, there really is a time to hate. As a matter of fact, we're enjoined by the New Testament that there are things that we're supposed to hate. And we think in terms of injustices or things like that, activities of practices, prejudice or oppression or whatever it is. Those are things that it's perfectly right for us to hate those things, not people. But to hate the effect of those things, I would even go so far as to say a hatred for our enemy is not out of place. He says there's a time for war and a time for peace. We know that is as far as the nations go, as far as the order of nations and civilizations. There are times. I mean, there are just times when it's an impossible thing to avoid, that in order to preserve the protection of the people, which a nation is supposed to do, it's going to have to go to war. It's going to be a part of the process in this fallen world. There's a time for peace, though, as well. Time to pursue those things which are nonviolent. So we see that when we look at this, though, and all of these things, these last parts that we were looking at, are dealing with those intents and purposes of the heart and the inner man. So we see that this poem actually orbits around three aspects of human life. It's dealing with the body and the soul and the spirit. The body, the temporal aspect of being born and dying and the stuff we do in between. We talk about our emotional response to all of these things with laughing and weeping. And then we talk about the intent of the spirit, what it is we're called to do. All of life is this journey that we pass through, and it's filled with these cycles. There are happy seasons, and there are seasons of purpose and industry, and we pass through hard times as well, of sorrow and loss. This is just the pattern that's here in this fallen world. This is all part of it. Everything has a time, and everything has an antithesis. There are things that balance the other out, opposing events and emotions as we go. This is the journey of life, and the professor's pointing this out, that there's nothing we can do about it. This is life under the sun. There's no way that we're going to dictate to the seasons that you're not going to change this time around. And for someone who has only life under the sun in view, then this can be a pretty miserable place if you look at it like that. I mean, this can be a pretty frightening place when you think in terms of being subject to the cycles that come and go. And if we, you know, if we find ourselves subject to that, then who are we? But if we see life as transcending those things, then we're not defined by seasons. We're not defined by seasons of sorrow and pain any more than we're defined by seasons of happiness and laughter. We're defined by something that transcends all of that, and that's God's love and God's ultimate purpose for life, which becomes another point of contention as this goes on later on. Verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the busyness that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So we imagine we're looking at the professor. We're still there in his study, and we see him putting the finishing touches on a large model ship that he's been building, one of those three-masted sailing schooners. And he steps back. He puts the last little piece on, and he steps back to admire it, and he smiles for a minute, and then all of a sudden his smile fades away. What's left over, he's asking there in verse 9. When the immediate pleasure of accomplishing something has passed and it's gone, what provides that permanent sense of satisfaction from the things that we set our hands to do, from the stuff. It's a question that he's asked already. He brought this up earlier in the last chapter. What's in this for me? What am I doing this for? Why do I do the stuff that I do? Why am I putting all these things together like this? And he tries to sum it up in his mind, and it just seems like so much busy work as he contemplates it. That God, if this is his plan, well, all he's doing is just giving us a bunch of stuff to do to keep us occupied while we take this little journey here in life, and it doesn't seem to be anything. What meaning does it have? But then, as he's looking at this model that he created, and he's squinting his eyes, and he's seeing the lines that it has on it, and he's admiring the form of it, something seems to spark in his mind, and he offers a few suggestions by way of observation. We get to verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So despite the repetition of the seasons, there's this beauty to be found here. Despite these things, these cycles that we go through of good times and bad times, despite the patterns that we see where we're conquering things and other times we're being conquered by things, despite all of that, as we step back and we look at the overall, we recognize that even in these patterns and cycles, there's a beauty to be seen in this thing. Now, some scholars believe that the word beauty that he uses there could also be translated as appropriate or right. So that would actually change the meaning significantly if we saw it that way. It would be saying that God made everything for an appropriate time, echoing what he had said earlier. But you'll find that the majority of translations and the majority of scholars actually believe that this is a good way to word this. He's talking about beautiful. Everything's got its own sense of beauty in a certain time, and it's in its appropriate time. And I think I like that idea better. I think that it seems to me to carry with it a continuation of thought as opposed to a repetition of an earlier thought, that there's something to be found, there's meaning to be found in the beauty of the thing that we see that unfolds before us. I guess that's where we have to let go of some of the crazy notions that have developed within Christianity over the years. We never want to dismiss advancing beauty in this world as something incidental or a distraction from real ministry of the church. This, the advancement of beauty, the creation of beauty, is a vital part of church ministry as far as I see it. That through art and music and poetry and photography or filmmaking, all these different means by which we as human beings can either capture or advance beauty in this world and add to the beauty that's here, that's represented here. I think this is an important thing. These are valid forms of advancing God's purposes in this world, advancing God's kingdom. I think that for a long time, the church was very hesitant about that because, I would say probably because evangelicalism, it's probably too much of a history lesson right now, but evangelicalism came out of, by and large, came out of the Anabaptist movement. We would say it came out of Protestantism, but really what we see is the Anabaptist iconoclastic movements represented in modern evangelicalism, and the iconoclastic movement determined that they were going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, that if the Roman Catholic Church had all these images and pictures and all this stuff, we're going to get rid of all of that. We're not going to have any of that stuff. We're just going to focus on leading people to Jesus and the spiritual things, and that's all that's really important. And by doing that, we cut ourselves off from a vital aspect of what our role is as representatives of God, as being image bearers of God in this world. We're supposed to be out advancing what's beautiful and adding to the beauty that's here and represented here. But I guess that's my own little thing. I feel it. The implication to me here is that the meaning that he was looking for is actually somewhat discovered in the beauty itself, in the beauty that you discover along the way, in the patterns and the cycles and all of it, that the beauty in and of itself carries an inherent purpose in representing who God is to this world. And there's something to that. I mean, there are things that you're not going to necessarily be able to articulate or quantify, but have you ever been down at the beach at sunset? and seen the clouds light up in a magnificent way, and it triggers something inside. You don't even know what to express in that. You just feel it. This is important. Why? Well, I don't know. This is important. It's important that I saw this. That this is something that I'm a participant in and I'm a witness of. There's something to that. There's something deeper in that. Something stirring in that. Which leads us to the next thing that the professor notes then. That the reason that there's something stirring in there that's bigger even than our ability to fully communicate is that God put eternity in our hearts. Come on, that is an awesome turn of a phrase right there. God put eternity in our hearts, encased that in this fragile, smallish flesh that we have, that sense of something much bigger on the inside than what we really have on the outside. God made us aware that there's something transcendent inside us and that we're connected to something that transcends all of the stuff that we're able to touch, taste, and smell and feel around here. We instinctively know that there's more to this existence that we have than just those mundane seasons and cycles that we go through. Something that stretches out the boundaries of what we can handle in physicality. God built us with an awareness that there is something much bigger going on here. That it's not something that's part of a purely rational construct, and it's not something that we're going to be able to prove out or experiment with on an empirical level, but we feel it. Every child is born into this world with a sense that there's more. You tell any child that there's a God, a child's not going to necessarily argue with that or demand proof on that. You tell a kid about Santa Claus. Okay, I just want to make sure I'm safe. I've blown that before. I've gotten some parents really mad at me. But you've got to be instructed on that kind of stuff. You've got to be taught not to embrace that, to dismiss that. But it's inherent in us. God put eternity in our hearts. It's inherent to us that we feel it. We extend out beyond just this. We don't know exactly what it means, and that's the whole thing. That even in itself, this thing that we're trying to describe here that the professor words so poetically is still something ineffable, something that we can't really completely define, that we can't put a nice, neat tagline on and feel satisfied that we've appropriately cataloged it in some way. It's mysterious. We can't find out what God has done, he says, from the beginning to the end. And the professor seems to be telling us here that there's a mystery to this journey, that there's a lot of mysterious stuff going on in this journey. And it's always going to be mysterious because God set it up that way. That was his intention. He was never planning on giving us a load of information that we were going to just carry around with us. This is an ongoing discovery of life. Life is happening that way. It always develops that way. And we need to accept that. And for us as post-enlightenment Western believers, we need to accept mystery a little bit more. We need to be getting ourselves more acquainted with the idea that we don't know everything, that we don't have an answer ready at hand for everything that comes up. We need to practice saying those words, "I don't know," and be okay with those words and not be afraid that somehow that's some way undermining our faith. We're okay with that. There's a mystery to this. This is just an ongoing thing. And we see all the time that even though we've advanced like we have, we're living in a world that, my dad used to preach a sermon called Changes, and it wasn't the David Bowie thing, but he was talking about how he was born. My dad was born in 1901. That's a long time ago. And so he passed away several years ago, but he'd marked off all the changes that he had seen and all the advancements that had taken place from the time that he was born. It's phenomenal when he starts listing those off, and you start realizing all the things that have happened, all the things that we've discovered, and yet we've advanced so much, but we still haven't gotten it all figured out. As a matter of fact, all the answers that we seem to have found have simply just pulled away another layer and made us realize that there's all kinds of other things that we don't understand. Those answers merely led to more questions that make us think, well, wait a minute, why is this like this then? So it's just an ongoing thing that those layers never seem to end. There's an eternity even built into that, a continual mystery and a continual exploration of the wonders of what this life is. Struggling to formulate some sort of meaning to this, independent of God, ends up becoming a futile thing. And that's the concept behind what the professor is saying. When we're trying to formulate some idea of meaning or some sort of identity apart from God's purposes in this whole thing, well, then it does seem just like a meaningless, random cycle that we're caught in here. Not necessarily random, but a cycle. But there's a bigness inside of us that we're not fully going to be able to understand. So the professor returns to an earlier conclusion there in verse 12. He says, I perceive that there's nothing better for them, talking about men or mankind, than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Now this is what he concluded in the last chapter, in chapter 2, as we were looking at that. This was the idea that he came to, figuring out that, you know, it's futile if we live for pleasure as an end in itself. To live like that, as he discovered, becomes dehumanizing. We become less than human the more we try to seek after pleasures. But if we see life as this gift from God, as something that he has personally provided to us, if we honor him in the giving of it and enjoy life in relationship with him and in relationship to him, life has all kinds of pleasures to be able to enjoy. You know, again, we have to address misconceptions that develop about who God is or what God is like, because there's a lot of times in which God seems to be portrayed as this cosmic killjoy. He's just, you know, he's not really going to be okay until we're all miserable. And you know, he'll keep working on it until we finally give in and realize that we can't be happy. But that's not the reality of it. In fact, we know that everything that is intrinsic, and that's an important thing to realize, everything that is intrinsic to this world and the way we find pleasure in this world was designed that way. It's designed to be pleasurable, and we're designed to take pleasure in it. I'll sit there and I'll look at the trees as they're blooming, and just the beauty of those leaves and the layers on them and the contrast of colors and shadow and light. And it's just, I get overwhelmed. I'm sitting there looking at that, and it's so beautiful to me. And I think, well, God, how did you know to make this in such a way that my eye is going to perceive that and find beauty in it and joy in that and pleasure in looking at that? And then I'm reminded, no, actually, this was here first. I was made in such a way that I'm going to enjoy the artistry and the craftsmanship that God put into this. But all of this stuff is here for us to enjoy, to find the pleasure in. That God delights in human enjoyment. I don't know that if we contemplate that enough. God delights in the idea that we enjoy life, that we find pleasure in things that he's provided to us in life. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we take off on some hedonistic crusade, that, boy, I'm just going to wring as much pleasure out of everything as I can. It's not that. It's not pleasure as an end in itself. But it's recognizing that there's a giver behind this gift, that there's somebody who knows us, who carefully created us to be able to perceive and enjoy things, to know what it is to have joy, to be able to comprehend and have an emotional response to things that provide a pleasurable response from us as human beings. God delights in that. That's his purpose. That's his plan. That's the way scriptures describe him. No, it's religious people that don't want us to have any fun. That's why I avoid them. So instead of being all bitter about the mystery to this whole thing, instead of being all twisted up and angry because of what we don't have a lot of the answers on these things. Why doesn't God tell me, you know, the whys and the wherefores of the things? Why doesn't God just explain this whole thing? Why are some answers withheld? Instead of being so angry about that sort of stuff, the professor goes over to a blossoming jasmine vine and sniffs at it, just inhales deeply all that fragrance and wonder. And he encourages us to take full advantage of what he has given us. Instead of being so upset because we don't have an answer about this or that, we should be using our time more wisely and enjoying and relishing in the things that he has given us, the things that we do have. To live life to its fullest is the idea behind what he's saying there, to do good and pay attention to the beauty that can be seen around us regardless of what's going on, and find the pleasure that does come from this life that he's built into this planet and built into us to respond to receive it as God's gift, not as an end in itself, not as the thing that will ultimately fulfill us, but as that gift from the one that we're in relationship with. Because true fulfillment is going to come as we surrender all the things that we don't understand. True fulfillment's going to come as we surrender to God's plans and his purposes anyway. It's never, you know, the contentment that we're looking for is not going to come from answers or controlling things. Who here feels better when they really actually do get to control something? All that does is open up a whole new level of pressure to put on you, because now it's my problem and I've got to deal with the whole thing. No, it's when we surrender this to God, to your purposes, to your plans, that all of a sudden there's a freedom and a wholeness and a satisfaction that comes with that. In fact, that's what he gets at here in verse 14. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks that which has been driven away. This is just reminding us. This is like as Ruth was teaching us last week, that God is sovereign in all these things. No one's going to tell God what to do. No one's going to go change his plans for him. And you've heard the old adage, if you want to make God laugh, you tell him about your plans. You go and explain to him what it is, the way things are going to be. Until we honor the reality that God is God and we are not, which is what it means to fear the Lord. When we talk about the fear of the Lord, or he says that in there, so that people fear before him. He's not talking about, you know, running around screaming or you know, being frightened in that sense. But it's that reverence, that honor, that recognition. Okay, you are God, I'm not God, and so I'm getting on board with your plan because I know that you're bigger than me. Until we surrender that way, we're going to find ourselves like the professor found himself, empty and dissatisfied and restless and hating life and discouraged. Most of our struggles in life come from us wanting to play God ourselves. I would say that as I sit down and I think about the things that have been the greatest struggles and the greatest senses of frustration and all the things that I go through, the things that really twist me up inside, are those times when I want to take control. I want to be God. I march around in my little world, in my little kingdom, demanding things that go my way. I want to control what happens. And this is why the greatest peace and sense of wholeness that we're ever going to find is going to come through surrender to God, to his plans and his purposes. Embracing the mystery of how God is going to work through all things to bring about what's good for us. So that even if I don't understand why this is happening or why things are developing this way, I surrender to the reality that God is in control, he's working things out, and I've been called according to his purposes, and I love him, so all of these things are working out for what's best for me. And I mean, we heard those dynamic stories from Ruth last week. How can you imagine somebody being burned like that, or going through a divorce like that, and seeing that something good is going to come out of it? And yet it does. I think about my own experiences and the things that I endured through the crazy church that I was involved in, and the pain in our family and the experiences that we had and the stuff that we went through that was so dark and discouraging. And you'd think, how in the world can anything good come out of that? And yet we wouldn't be gathered around here like this tonight. We wouldn't be here for each other right now if it weren't for those things that went on. So God is working in these things. We learn to surrender to that. We recognize he's God and I'm not. And so I'll trust him. That is the very nature of faith. That's the real nature of faith. Not dictating to God through our claims and demands of what he's going to do, but surrendering to his will and purposes. Now, verse 15 is a little confusing when it says there, you know, that which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks. I mean, it sounds like something that the old man from Karate Kid would say, but it's trying to convey the concept that God is the orchestrator of all of these cycles. The idea is that God actively pulls those things that have gone before back into history and applies them again. Applies them, and it's a repeated cycle for the next group of travelers that comes on this scene and floods over this planet. God pulls these experiences back. I mean, this is profound, but it's odd because, again, we're describing the cyclical nature of you know, that circular kind of pattern of life, which is not normal for Jewish thought. Jewish thought was very linear. It was always with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And here we're presented with this cyclical thing where we're suggesting multiple beginnings and multiple endings. But I don't believe that he's speaking necessarily on a global scale, even though we're talking globally. The application of it is in the details, because that's where Ecclesiastes is residing here, on the experiential individual level, in the details of the things. In other words, it might be getting too whatever. What he's saying in this is that the things that you're going through are not just peculiar to your circumstances or your situation. This is not just peculiar to you. You think that everything is unfair and life is going this way and you don't understand why it's happening. Look, you're not the only one who's gone through something like this. It doesn't seem unfair to you. All the people who came before us and all the people who come after us will wrestle with these same questions, that experience these same things. This is a common experience for the human race. This is life after the fall. So what really matters in this, and this is what he's trying to get across in that, is that what we do with these experiences, these things that we keep going through, the things that the human race keeps going through, what really matters is not so much the going through it, but how we respond to that. That is, how it is that we're relating to the one who's put these patterns into place to lead us in a certain direction. That's the thing that matters. And so if that's the case, how we respond, if that's the thing that is of supreme importance, then everything has meaning. You realize that. All of a sudden, in this just swift little statement, he's eradicated the thing of, it's all meaningless, it's all pointless, I don't know why. Why do we have to go through this? If it's about how we respond, if it's about what God is doing as he's molding us and shaping us from this birth to death experience, then everything has meaning. Everything has meaning. Does that mean that, whether it's God's will then that all this suffering? Well, no. I'm not going to go that far. I know that sin has its place in this, and so much of the pain and the suffering that we see as a result of that. But because God is sovereign and the orchestrator of things, he's going to use whatever is necessary in order to bring about his desired intents and purposes for the human race. So we wouldn't say that it's God's will that all this pain happens, but we would say nothing is without significance. Everything has meaning at that point. All of a sudden, life takes on a completely different light. All of a sudden, everything means something more than it did before we read that. So if it's all about our response, then life is full of meaning. Okay, we get to verse 16, and it marks another section which is going to run through the next few chapters, and it's reverting back to his catalog of vanities under the sun, the in the natural world as we observe it apart from God, all these things that seem discouraging. We could title it Why Everything is Stupid, Part 2. Verse 16, he says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work." Okay, so the professor has taken the needle off of the bird's album, and he turned off the turntable, and he switched on his iPod, and he flips to a low-quality pirated copy of Bulls on Parade by Rage Against the Machine, and he begins nodding his head to the beat as it goes. And the question that he comes back to is one that comes up so often in our experiences in life. It's kind of like, wait a minute. Okay, so if God's got a purpose and he's in control and he's got this great plan and all, then why is there this evidence of this great injustice in the world? Why do we see so much injustice on almost a daily basis? How come we hear about murderers going free and innocent people being oppressed by either governments or other people, stronger people? I mean, is this, like we said, is this part of God's plan? And the professor finds solace in going back to that larger picture again. Even though under the sun it looks like injustice reigns, even if there is injustice now, justice will happen. He's saying, you know, there's a time and a season. Eventually, it will happen. That God's appointed a time for justice. And, you know, that's just one of those things. I'm not going to bog down on it. You know, God's grace. I'm one of the biggest proponents of God's grace that you're probably going to find. I'm always accused of antinomianism or saying that nothing matters, and that's not true. But you're never going to really preach grace unless you're accused of those things. But the fact is God's grace and his love for us did not nullify justice. It didn't take justice out of the equation. Justice is still going to be happening. God satisfied justice by sacrificing Christ on our behalf. And it's not like God was trying to appease himself. I know that statement has been made, but it's not that. It's so that the concept of justice can be upheld. It's so that God can be true to himself as what constitutes what's just and right. And so grace simply provides us a means to have that price paid, but it's going to be paid one way or the other. We're going to have a hard time trying to get around that. Justice is God's deal, and I won't bog down on that, but I mean that is a thing. That's probably where the rub comes and why there's a controversy about the issues of justice and judgment and all of that, because as the church we've had this nasty habit of trying to be the arbiters of justice and judgment ourselves, and that's not our role. That's not our right, our privilege, or our qualification to ever make that call. It's not up to us who God is forgiving and who he's judging. That is just not our call. And you know, I guess we could pound on that forever, but for the professor, he may have just been repeating this as something to give him a quick sense of solace, you know, repeating the common wisdom. But he presses this further here in verse 18. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see they themselves are but beasts. So the idea is when there's no justice in society, when there's oppression that's going on, there's very little that separates us from the animal kingdom. We prey on the weakest. We advance our own will without any thought for anyone else. We act out of that pure animal instinct of self-preservation and self-advancement. But then this leads the professor to another thought as he examines the details under the sun. Verse 19, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. And man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? So the professor, he walks over to a shelf and he picks up a human skull off the shelf and he goes and he sets it over by a taxidermied box that's sitting there near his desk. And he looks at them and compares them side by side. Just like the same fate awaited the wise man and the fool, both of them will end up in the grave. So the same, he extrapolates, is true with the animals as well. And once a person or an animal has passed beyond this life, who knows what's going to happen? That's still a great mystery. There's nothing observable that we can ascertain as to what makes the difference there. There's no discernible, observable difference between animals and humans in death, when it comes to death. And when he questions the spirit of man going up and the beast going down, he's not really formulating a clear picture of an afterlife scenario here. He's just indicating that there's no natural evidence that would indicate that humans have a greater meaning or a nobler spirit than animals based on what we can see. that sort of thing is going to require revelation. There's nothing that we can look at and observe with the natural eye that makes any kind of distinction there at all. The scriptures have to reveal that to us. That has to be something that's provided by revelation, that man's made in the image of God, that meaning and transcendent and eternity in our hearts and all of that sets us apart from the animal kingdom. But from a human standpoint, a dead dog and a dead human being are going to both decompose and both pretty much share the same kind of fate. They'd look pretty much the same, probably smell pretty much the same. The bugs and the critters and everything else seem to enjoy them just about the same. So much of this is unknown to us. That's what he's saying in terms of trying to just observe it with our eyes and make some sort of sense out of it that way. And, you know, he does affirm in this, I would guess that the idea that he's trying to say is that the human spirit would be returning to God in death, but there's no knowing how it resides there in the first place. There's no knowing how this process happens or what goes on there. That's why, see, in his statements here, we have to remember, we've got to be so very careful about creating dogmatic, angry positions about our Christian ideas concerning afterlife and post-mortem experiences. The Bible gives us very, very little information about what that goes on, apart from the revelation that there's a good ending for some and a not good ending for others. And pretty much after that, we've got a lot of metaphor and a lot of things that, you know, that kind of help reinforce that picture, but not a lot of details. There's a lot of mystery in the details in that. And we've got to be careful that we don't start getting angrily dogmatic about our positions in terms of that. But just from an outward observation, just by looking at the thing, it's just a biological thing. It's just decomposition and dust. And of course, this is kind of a downer in and of itself, but we notice, at least I believe, we notice that the professor is smiling as he says all this. And all of a sudden we realize that we're supposed to infer something by these words, that there's actually a connection between what he said there in verse 18 that led up to this other point, that justice and concern for the weak is the very thing that does reveal our differentiation from the animal kingdom, is the very thing that reveals God's presence on the earth, that seeking justice and promoting the well-being of the weak is part of how we live the life we were intended to live. That's how we go about fulfilling our vocation as being image bearers of God in this world. Okay, verse 22 ends the chapter, but not the theme, it'll go on from there. But verse 22, he says, I saw that there was nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Again, he's returning to this repeated theme. Learn to appreciate the joys, the pleasures that we have at hand. And as he's pointed out before, are God's gift to us, because this is our lot. And when he says this is our lot, he's not saying that's in a negative context. We usually think in terms of that being, you know, that's my lot in life. But what he means is that that's just what's been provided. This is what has been provided to us by God. Let's enjoy this, what he's provided. In other words, you know, the stuff that's right here, right now. Even though there's beauty and difficulty, even though there's pleasure and pain and hardships, the hardships hone our character, and the happiness is here to enjoy right here and right now. Take advantage of it. What's here? What's been provided for us? But, you know, trying to figure out what happens after this life, the mysteries that are hidden, trying to get all that all hammered out. We leave these things in God's hands and we trust him. Take him at his word that there's a good ending coming. Just trust in that. Don't hammer out the details or try to get it figured out. Just trust that for those who've embraced his offer of salvation, that he's got good plans for it. And that's really all we can do. And I think it's the way that we find the godly contentment that Paul refers us to in being content with godliness is great gain. So when we come back, the professor will wrestle with all this other stuff. Sorry I kept you so late. So Father, just thank you so much for the word that you give to us here. We thank you for that professor who's guiding us through these really deep thoughts, things that we could easily pass by as we're gazing at the TV, not really contemplating what life is about and the richness of it and the layers of it and the purpose and the plan that you've got unfolding in all of these things. So I just pray, Lord, that your word finds its way into our hearts and enables us to see life from a different perspective. Help us gain that from this book. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.